So, we've got part two of the relationship between Greek wisdom, secular knowledge, the Torah, how these things kind of integrate, how do they come together, what are we supposed to do with this? And just for the sake of recap, even though the Shiur really has no bearing on the first time around, just what we discussed the first time around was... We saw in Chazal itself, just to show that the, today's series, today's Shiur is going to really start from much later period, early modern period. So I don't want to just like make it sound like we're coming out of nowhere, we're not basing ourselves on anything. So we already saw that Chazal, there are different orientations within different pieces in Gemara and Medrash in terms of how does one balance the two opposing or parallel. Notions of secular knowledge on the one hand and Torah on the other hand. And we saw that there was a tension. Different Rishonim had different interpretations, and that if you looked at least in the medieval era in terms of the bulk of the Rishonim and the work that they presented, that we saw like there was a pattern that in Ashkenaz it was really a Torah-only sort of approach, and other knowledge and other wisdom was really shunned and really looked down upon. You had formulations of anyone who was engaged in other areas of knowledge is engaged not be cursus and things like that. That was kind of the Ashkenazic mentality. And then we had, so on the other hand, that when it comes to in Sfarad, when it came to the Muslim Spain, where the Rambam was reigning supreme, so we saw that there was a much broader perspective that was adopted, and this was really an era that was really flourishing with a lot of different, not just in terms of Torah innovation and Torah knowledge, but also in terms of incorporating the best of the secular world and other ideas that have that were evolving in the general culture, and incorporating that into the Torah learning and into their general milieu. So today we kind of wanted to move. We're going to skip over, the early modern era. We're going to kind of jump into more modern / contemporary, and hopefully that'll kind of give us a sense in terms of some ways of kind of organizing and addressing how we ourselves might kind of integrate some of these topics, how we can kind of view this balance between secular knowledge, living in the world on the one hand, and our commitment to Torah and our learning of Torah on the other, and how these two things can work together. So I wanted to start with, basically, I guess the outline of this year is kind of to show, I wanted to start with maybe a, an extreme approach on the side that kind of really, I guess, follows the Ashkenazic sort of a mentality of really shunning Torah, really shunning the secular knowledge, and really shunning the notion of trying to incorporate that into the world of the yeshiva, into the world of learning. And then from there, kind of show how there are different levels or multiple stages or different sort of constructs of how you might actually say that the two things really do work together. And we'll see how there are some that are more minimalist and some that are very, very maximalist. So we can start on page number one with the thought of Rav Elchanan Wasserman, who lived in the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s, and he took a very, very extreme position against secular knowledge, against the college, against university. He was very open about this. He wrote a couple of famous pieces on this, and I have two parts of it here. Now, I just want to, as way of a background, just to at least mention that no one really is saying that secular wisdom has to be completely neglected and completely shunned when it comes to its necessity for earning a livelihood. I mean, even the opinions already we saw in Chazal, even the opinions like Rabbi Shmuel in the Gemara Menachos, who said, find a time that's not day and not night, and that's a perfect time to learn secular wisdom, to learn Greek wisdom. So even he is quoted in different sources in the Yerushalmi and other places. Even he's quoted as saying that a father is obligated to teach his son whatever knowledge is necessary to perform a trade properly. Even Rabbi Shmuel, who takes a very extreme position against the Greek wisdom, admits and says that it's a davar pashut, that someone has to be able to earn a living, and of course whatever is necessary in terms of learning a trade, in terms of mastering any sort of area or curriculum for that, that's not really part of this discussion. This is really, the discussion here is really more of a lishma sort of discussion. You know, if someone has time that could be devoted to learning Torah, someone has time that could be devoted to learning other things, so how should one view his time, and how should one allot his time? What kind of values are there outside of the world of Torah? So that's really what the discussion is here. And we have Rabbi Chanan, who basically said there's no value whatsoever. Said that when it comes to secular knowledge, he was asked this explicitly here in source number one. This is written, this is from the notes of some of his shirim in Kobet Shirim. And here in Simon Mem Zayin, he was asked, you can see, She'ela. The question was, Im mutar lehisasek b'chachmos chitzonios, ube'eza ofen yiskayim ha'heter hazeh. Is it permissible to engage in other sort of external wisdom? And in what way, what sort of structure would be the appropriate way to use this permissibility, if there is one?
Let me ask you, when he talks about Chochmat Chitzoniyot, is he talking only about things like philosophy, or is he talking also about being an electrical engineer or whatever?
So from Rav Chanan, it's a little bit less clear. I don't know if we'll see. We'll go through. I don't recall him really spelling out, you know, the different sorts of fields. We'll see as we go on. We will talk about some different areas, meaning in terms of philosophy or science and, you know, other things like that. For him, it's more. We'll see. The distinction he really basically makes is something that is going to be necessary for a job versus something that is not necessary for a profession. If it's necessary for a profession, so, you know, electrical engineering is a very practical sort of item. I mean, you have to ask, if you would say, I want to go into the field of being a professor of philosophy, so then it's a little bit unclear, because he's very much against, if he thinks something has, you know, heretical content, so he thinks there's no circumstance that you can learn. He says heretical content, that's a yeharig val yavor, that's like pikuach nefesh. You can't study anything with that sort of content whatsoever. So there, he might even say, even if you decided that's you're going to be your means of earning a livelihood, he might even say that's not a good avenue to pursue. But his general distinction is going to be between those two things. He doesn't really, at least in his writings, distinguish between things that you might call more of a, like, an understanding of the natural world or how things work in a scientific way versus, you know, the more esoteric philosophical bent.
Could that be one of the reasons why, when you said earlier, the Ashkenazim shunned any secular knowledge because they were surrounded by Christians who were considered Odei Avodah Zarah? While the Sephardim, Rambam says that Muslims are not.
Right, because they believe they are a monotheistic religion. Yeah, so I mean, I think, right, that was, you know, part of the idea that we, you know, we kind of talked about a little bit last time, and we didn't hit on that exact distinction. But yes, that generally the Ashkenazic versus the Sephardic sort of a difference was very much based on the surrounding cultures, and that would be another distinction that could be employed to understand that. So here, he was asked this question: is it permissible to study other things? And his teshuva is Hashela Hazos Nechlekes Lekama Chalakim. So he has a long response to this. It's got many parts. I included a few snippets here. Imahisaskus Hazos Mevia Lekriat Sefarim Sheish Behem Minus Usser. So if it's gonna lead to any sort of engagement in heretical apikarsus, so that's for sure forbidden. Hakoris Sefarim Elu Over Belosa Say De Losa Sura Chare Lavavchem Ya Al Tifnu El Alilim. Right, you're in violation of many different isurim. He compares it to Avodah Zarah. He says this is, it's a Yehargi Val Yavor, Pikuach Nefesh. That's something that's just untouchable. Here, if you go to the Dalet, in the second paragraph, so he says, Hecha She'ein Tzarech L'lomda B'Torah Umnus. So he says, you know, straight out, I just want to let, you know, introduce this. It's, if you're not doing this for the purpose of acquiring a profession, El Shirosa L'Hishtas She'eba, Yesh makom lasor mishum bitul Torah. So if it's just because you want to do it lishma, so then you've got to figure out, well, there's a balance. You know, there's a chiyuv of Talmud Torah, and then there's other things. These things, we're not talking about apikarsis, because that's not part of the discussion. We're not talking about earning a livelihood, because that's okay. But if you're just talking about general worldly knowledge, so then there's a balance. You've got the balance between your obligation to learn Torah and your interest in these other realms. So he says, when you have that balance, so Bittul Torah is going to win out. If it's if you have a choice of learning Torah, these other things, so the Torah is what one should. The Torah is what one should put their energies towards. Dehecha de'ail Yerkaleo Bishra Vichavri Vinira Debezem Mairi Harama. Finding quotes from he wants to say this is what the Rama holds in Shulchan Aruch. Where's the important part? So go towards the end. He's discussing about, you know, the lashon of the medrash that we quoted last time, that maybe there's only a problem if you make your secular knowledge your main focus. If you make that your main focus, then that's a problem. But maybe if it's tafel, if it's just a secondary focus, that would be okay. So he quotes v'yeshli histapik towards the middle of the second paragraph of the Dalet. V'yeshli histapik, the last two words in the line. B'taima de'ein la'sosam keva. So what's the problem with making them, with making secular pursuits the keva, the permanent sort of focus? Im hum yishum bitol Torah, im kein efshar jelo shayach zeh ela be'anashim velo b'nashim. So he kind of puts himself into a little bit of a corner because he's so against this because of a bitol Torah, from a bitol Torah standpoint. So he says, well, if that's the case, so then we know that there is a distinction on a purely obligational level that men are obligated in Talmud Torah and women are not obligated in Talmud Torah on a purely, on a pure level of obligation. So when you talk about bitol Torah, so that's an isser that only applies to men. So according to this sort of concept, yeah.
When was this written? This 1930?
He was teaching in the early 1900s. I mean, when exactly it was written, I don't, when this was recorded.
He was sort of like before those. He was Reb Mendel Kaplan's Rebbe, and he was his Rebbe in Baranovich, like before the Second World War, because Reb Mendel was like that old when he came.
He was killed in the war.
So, you know, so this was in the early 1900s, you know, when he was teaching. I don't know exactly what date this is. These are just the notes from his shiur. He did not write this himself. There's a letter here which I included to take a look at.
Some of it was his son in California.
Could be. I don't know exactly. We have a few. There are three. There are a few Svarim. There's the Kovet Shirim, which are the notes from his Shirim, and then he did write one sefer, the Kovet Ha'aros, which is actually written by him himself, I believe. So this is what these are the notes from his Shirim. But so this was written in the sometime in the 1900s, early 1900s. So he says. So he says, but really that's not 100% true, because women do have the obligation to be fluent in, for sure, those areas of halacha. You know, he's even coming from a more right-wing perspective, and he's condoning women learning at least those areas which are relevant to their own daily life and their observance. Oh, efshar dafilu belav hachtaima. And even without this, Ein lasos keva shelo yitein lahem chashivas kechashivas haTorah. So even without the notion of bittul Torah, it's not a question of this balance. It's, in the end of the day, you shouldn't give the same priority and the same importance to secular wisdom that you should be giving to Torah. Torah is of a different nature, and that should be clear in how we conduct our days and how we exert our energies. V'lo yishkach ki tachlis hayetzira hi rak haTorah. We shouldn't ruin our perspective. Our perspective always has to be clear that the purpose of the creation, that is for Torah.
Is that how he would answer if you asked him, what about the Dala Malashi Vladikoris?
So he does get into I didn't put it here. He does get into this whole discussion. Well, what about the Rambam, and what about issues like what you're mentioning here in terms of where it's important to know these things? So he acknowledges that there are models for being involved in some of the Chachma Chitzonios, and he also he acknowledges that this is true, but in the end of the day, his basic premise is the Rambam was the Rambam, we're not the Rambam, and the risk is so high when you're engaging in these sort of in these philosophical debates and these philosophical concepts that are based in completely heretical notions that are inconsistent with Judaism. So his basic approach is that, for the Hamonam, that should not be something that's pursued. So this is his general approach. He's Ad kidei kach, it's so extreme that this is a letter that was actually written to him because there, and this is somewhat of a, I think, a well-known incident that when things in Europe were getting bad and the situation was worsening for the Jewish people, so there were yeshivas in America that actually extended invitations and offered to provide visas for some of the rabbanim to come over from Europe and to come to America. And he was offered from YU, we'll see from the letter who he's addressing, he was offered a position in Yeshiva University by Dr. Revel. And he was also offered a position right here in Chicago at the Skokie Yeshiva. And he was this offer was extended to him. And he writes in a letter back. He declines. He says, no, I'm not going to accept. He says here in source number two, the bottom is his actual letter and the top is the typed version, so it's more legible. Kibalti es michtava v'ein biyadi lasos baze lefikach lo heshavti. So he says, I received this letter and I'm not able to respond to it. Hayeshivos be'America Hayecholos lahavi talmidim hein yeshivos yeshivas Dr. Revel, right? That's Yeshiva University, right? Yeshiva University, in New York. Ubeis hamedrash l'Torah b'Chicago. Ushtehen hein mekomos sakana. The ruchnius. These are two places which are dangerously evil for the spiritual realm. Ki mishalchos ki ruach chof beruach chofshit. That this they go, there's a free spirit over there. They're engaged in all this secular university knowledge. It's a free spirit over there. You never know what's going to happen. Uma betza livroach misakana gashmios lisakana ruchnius. And what good would it be? I know it's not looking good over here in Europe, but what good would it be to run away from a physical damage, from physical danger, just to run into a spiritual danger?
What year was that?
There's so much for Ruach HaKodesh.
This was in the late 1930s, I believe.
Oh boy!
I believe
for the Gedolei Ador having Ruach HaKodesh.
It's a very sad letter.
What I've heard is like sort of a sanitized version that he didn't want to abandon his talmidim. And
right.
Knew that this would happen, and he said.
Right. Well, I mean, I think part of it. I think that's true. I mean, they do say. That doesn't appear in this short letter. They do say that was part of his thinking. He didn't want
to
leave the Talmudim. But I think. But part of the way I understand it, at least the way some of the things I've read on it imply that it was the offers weren't just made to him. There were offers that were extended to Talmidim also. And he actually said, the Talmidim, when asked him, he said, it's usur to go there, meaning it is usur to leave, to leave.
Expression. I feel the stein is on in treif in America. Yeah. Even the stones are treif in America. That was the provision.
Right. And that was
philosophy.
Right. And that's the message that he gave over to his Talmidim. And yeah, he wasn't going to leave himself. He wasn't going to abandon his Talmidim. That's true. But it was more than that. It was that he thought that this was, there was really no benefit to leaving Europe and going to America, especially in involving himself in yeshivas that were also connected with university learning. He thought that was, you might as well perish and be in physical harm because the spiritual harm is so great that you couldn't leave.
I'm surprised that yeshiva like Chaim Berlin or Tor Vadas
contacted.
Yeah, he said he contacted them, so that might be where he didn't want to abandon the Talmidim come in. I don't know because he's not focusing on America per se as much as he's focusing on those two institutions. And he does say that he did contact the who did he contact? He contacted Shlomo Hyman. Right. And it sounds like he, seeked advice or gave some advice, but it's not exactly clear from the letter exactly what the nature of that conversation was. He contacted him, but it's not clear from the letter what the purpose of that contact was. But at least you see from what he espoused when people asked him directly in terms of university education and practically in a very, very extreme fashion. So you see what this is an approach of vehement opposition, and reading a letter like this is just it's heart wrenching. It's heart-wrenching. It really is. It really is.
happened and come.
Well, he came to America fundraising. Yeah, he came to America to raise funds for his yeshivas. That was something, and he developed relationships with Rabbanim here, with people here, and he made an impact here. It's true, but
and things were bad when he came, so he didn't come in good times.
But that was his position. So let's move on from there, and let's go towards some of the other approaches. And we'll start with the most minimal, and then we'll work our way up. So the first approach, I guess the more minimal approach to kind of integrating the secular world of knowledge and wisdom into one's Torah personality is the utilitarian model. This is a model, I think, that is really associated most prominently with the Gra. And here I quoted from, I saw quoted in a Hakdama to one of his Talmidim wrote a Sefer, and in the Hakdama to the Sefer, so the Talmud was speaking about his Rebbe, the Gra, and I quoted a small piece of it here. So you can see on the first line, in the middle of the first line, so this is the Talmud was a Rav Baruch Shklov, I believe his name was, and he wrote the Sefer called Pas HaShulchan. And in the Hakdama, so he says, "Bipnimio seha v'chutzo seha, ko amar kol achachmos nitzrachim l'torasenu akidosha ukululimba." Right, both in its in an inner and outer sense, it's the case that chachmas ha'olam, right, the wisdom in the world is necessary for our holy Torah and is included in it. V'yedam kulam l'tachlitam. Right, and the student talks about how the Gra was well aware of, was well versed in this knowledge. V'hizkiram chachmas algebra umishulashim, and some of the particular things that were mentioned. I think it's well known that the Gra encouraged Talmidim to translate the different secular works into Hebrew to make sure that it was accessible for Bnei Yeshiva to understand. He thought that there was clearly a value in understanding some of these secular subjects. Now, again, this is for the purpose of understanding Torah, as we'll see. So he specifically mentioned things like mathematics, algebra, mishulashim, geometry, I assume that means, v'handasa, which is engineering, v'chokhmas musica, right, musical composition, v'shivcha harbe hu hayomer az ki rov tame Torah v'sodos shirei halavim v'sodos tikuni azohar yefshar leida bilada. There are many parts of the Torah kedosha, the kabbalistic elements, the sodos, the shirei halavim, the shir of the levim, and the zohar, etc. There are many parts of Torah which these subjects really were very necessary to fully appreciate and integrate and understand those elements of Torah. So this is something that the Gra was definitely a proponent of. So this is, again, it's not the most fundamental inclusion. It's a much more practical, utilitarian inclusion that the secular knowledge is something that will enhance our ability to understand and further appreciate and fully appreciate the Torah. And that's the notion that you get from here in the Gra. Rav Lichtenstein in Leaves of Faith, he presents this as one of his options when he goes through his discussion on this topic and talks about the various levels of which the secular wisdom and understanding is beneficial to the spiritual Jew. So on the on his more basic level, he notes that this is one of its merits. And he writes here, source number 4, secular knowledge is not merely a tactical weapon. Right, this is actually a reference to what he wrote earlier, which is a point that you made a minute ago, which was, he talked about secular knowledge being a tactical weapon in the sense that when we're engaged in the world, that we're going to come across things that are going to cause us to question and cause us to have to understand where our beliefs are really coming from and perhaps be challenged by others, and we have to know how to respond and to be able to do so in a real way. So in that sense, being able to understand what the world is coming from, what's the worldview that's out there that's in contrast and trying to challenge our own, so to be able to respond to that and to be able to have our strong beliefs beliefs in spite of that, so you have to really understand where they're coming from, and that's part of why secular knowledge is important, and he calls that as a tactical weapon. However, it possesses considerable intrinsic merit as well. It has more intrinsic merit. We may consider it under two headings. First, secular studies are often invaluable as a direct accessory to Talmud Torah proper. Right? Consider simply the aid we derive by elucidation or comparison from linguistics in Amos, history in Malachim, agronomy in Zroim, physiology in Nida, chemistry in Chametz Matzah, philosophy in Yesodei HaTorah, psychology in Avodah Zarah, political theory in Sanhedrin, Torah in Baba Batra. And he says, you know, one could continue almost indefinitely. You could go on and on and on and point out how in each area of Torah there are fields of secular study and expertise that are truly enhancing and sometimes even almost necessary to really fully grasp and understand just what the Torah is trying to say. I think you actually referenced this piece last time.
Month,
so this is
three, 4 weeks. Or
this is the piece that where he goes through and mentions that he goes a step further and mentions even on an additional level in the practical realm. This is, I think he mentions this in another essay that he wrote, which appears in Judaism's Encounter with Other Cultures. He wrote a much lengthier essay there, and he has another element in terms of this practical level where he talks about how in order to properly apply and to integrate the Torah and the Halacha into modern-day application, so one needs to be aware of how things work. He says specifically in the socioeconomic realm, in terms of how we understand rules between neighbors, hilchos shchenim, how we understand, hilchos poalim, how we, labor laws, things like that. These are all areas that halacha has a lot to say about, and how to kind of integrate that and apply that into today's modern age entails that we understand the halacha, and it entails that we understand the reality on the ground and how things operate in the world around us.
He goes, but you said that's only one aspect.
That's one aspect.
He goes much farther.
Yes, he himself.
Yeah, I've read an article, an essay by him where it was about like Menschlichkeit between people, just your relationships with people, and he mentioned how literature could improve one's just the way he gets along with other people or appreciates or understands other people, things like that.
Yes,
I mean, he went that far.
Right. This is just stage number one. This is, on the most basic level, which he himself, in his essay, he's kind of mapping out some of the different approaches. So he actually associates this with the approach of the Gra, which is what we mentioned a minute ago. So that's kind of the most basic level, the utilitarian model. It's a practical conception where the secular knowledge is really coming to service our understanding and our appreciation of Torah. But we can go much more extreme than that. We can go much further than that, and go much more fundamental than that, and that's what you're hinting at. And I decided to kind of show that in two different aspects. So the first is his guess is known as the mystical model. So the mystical model is the model that was really espoused by Rav Kook, and I'm not an expert in Rav Kook and his thoughts. I'm not an expert in Kabbalah, which is a lot of what his thought was about. But his stuff is really fascinating. So every once in a while I try to dabble in it. And here he has a few very interesting things to say in terms of where he's coming from and how he views the world and how this balance between understanding the Torah and learning the Torah and integrating it with the secular wisdom comes into play. So it's a fascinating, fascinating model. So let's just take a look at a few things, and some of this will be on the on the broader scale, and then we'll see how he actually incorporated it into a speech that he gave at the invocation at Hebrew University. So the first is just in terms of some of his basic thoughts. So in Oros HaKodesh, here in source number 5, Rav Kook writes that Yesh Olam Shel Chol V'Olam Shel Kodesh, that the world exists really on two planes. There's the secular, the mundane, and the holy. Olamim Shel Chol V'Olamim Shel Kodesh. Ha'olamim Sosrim Zeh Et Zeh. So these worlds, the holy and the secular, they are contradictory to one another. Kimuvan hastira hi subjektivit. But it's understood that this contradiction is subjective. This is not a real contradiction. Ha'adam b'hashagaso ha'mitzumtzemes eino yocho lefasher ben ha'kodosh ben ha'chol. So man, in his limited understanding, in his limited grasp, is not able to bridge the kodesh and the chol. Ve'eino yocho lahashvos estiroseyan, he's not able to rectify this contradiction. Ve'hein omnam miyushavos b'rum olam b'machon kodesh hakadoshim. But don't worry, in the heights, in the, you know, in the elevated spheres of the world, so these two things are, of course, reconciled, and this is what he refers to as the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So we already see this mentality of where Rav Kook is coming from, the notion of Kodesh HaKadoshim, the holiest of holies, is this sort of integration between the Kodesh and the Chol. So now we have to figure out what that integration means. What does he mean by that? But at least you see that's the orientation. That's where he's coming from on the most basic level. So in source number 6, we get a little bit of a fuller sense. Omnam, this is also from a later part of the Oros HaKodesh. Omnam acharei kol eila masigim bideya berura. Right? After all of this, we will have a full appreciation and we'll understand with clear understanding. Shekol eila heim devarim ovrim. That all of this is transient. V'hisalus shel hakol lekodesh. Right? The elevation of everything that there is in the world to holiness. Ula achva, and to unity, la hashvaya, to equity, la dinos, pleasantness, hu harayon hanitzchi. That's the eternal idea. The eternal idea is the notion that everything in this world is ultimately elevated to Kodesh, right? God is part of this world in every aspect. There's nothing in the world that's not godly. It's just that some things are obviously godly and some things are less obviously godly. And the whole progression of the world, the whole progression of history and the role of the Jewish people is to basically see that all those things come to be reached to reach their full potential. And that's what's the eternal purpose. That's the eternal concept that there is. Hachai tamid b'chol ruach nediva. This is what's constantly present. V'azehiru shel ha'avdalos, heinam devarim shotfim v'ovrim. Right? The notion of a separateness, of these distinctions and these apparent contradictions, that's just current and passing. It's not something that's permanent. Novim mechai esha, it emerges from the temporary. Harayon ha'kali shel ha'shvaya shehu yisod tovas ha'lev avas ha'brios ha'zacha. Right? The notion of this ultimate confluence, which is the foundation for a good heart and avas abrios of in the loving of the creations, hazacha of the pure creations. Holechu b'marachei harazim behelas hanitzotzos hamefuzaros bechol amkei aklipos. So this comes in the system of the esoteric system which elevates all the sparks that are spread throughout the world, the sparks of holiness that are spread throughout the world and hidden deeply in the klipos. The klipos are these negative shells that cover the holy sparks. Ubarayon hagadol shel hitpachus hakol kedusha gemura umuchletes. And this notion, this is a clear and firm that the notion that ultimately all of these things are going to be elevated and brought to life.
So is he implying that learning secular subjects would be help the process of breaking these?
Yes. So, we'll see. So this is right. We're starting from the broad thought to kind of understand the construct that he's working with, and now we'll get to a little bit more into. There are places where he kind of explicitly talks about secular knowledge. Here he's alluding to it, and he's going beyond just the secular knowledge. He's talking about secular and holy in general. But here he's alluding to it, and he refers to all this in his invocation at the Hebrew University, which is again clearly showing that this is part of the same story. So here he takes this even a step further, and he talks. This is in Oros HaKodesh, in the first section of Oros HaKodesh, in Chelek Aleph, in the section called Chochmas HaKodesh, and he talks about Binyan HaKodesh VeAchol, the notion of building the holy and the mundane. And he starts off with a fascinating comment. Really, it's almost shocking. HaKodesh Tzarech SheYibne Al Yesod HaChol. The holy, it's necessary for the holy to be built on the foundation of the mundane. Hachol Hinei hachomer shel hakodesh, the material that is used to build the kodesh is the mundane. The hakodesh lo tsura, the kodesh is what forms this chomer. You take a material and you form it, so the kodesh is the formation of this mundane material. V'chomash sheyihye hachomer yoser etan, and to the extent that this material, this chol, is more firm and more established, so tia hatsura yoser chashuva. So then the form, what you can make from it, is going to be that much more significant, that much more impressive. Right? The better the materials, so the more impressive the ultimate result. So again, the notion of the mundane, the foundation that one has in the world, in the whole, in the mundane, in secular knowledge, so that will ultimately create a much higher level, a much loftier spiritual result that will elevate the person in his spiritual existence that much more. And he goes further. He says, Lifamim, this is part of his thought, that the world kind of went through stages and is going through stages where it's ultimately going to end up in a state of perfection. Lifamim yesha kodesh mitamer ba'achol ad shemedal del sachomer. So sometimes kodesh kind of gets subsumed by the chol. Sometimes the kodesh subsumes the chol. That sometimes the kodesh is so strong that it's emphasized to such an extent that it becomes disproportionate, and it is, you know, almost, I think mitamer is like it means abuse. You know, it kind of abuses the chol ad shemedaldel sachomer, to the point where it has a negative impact on the ultimate result. Meaning, if you have a weaker foundation, so then the ultimate result is not going to be as impressive. So sometimes when there's too much of a focus on the kodesh, when the kodesh is becoming disproportionate to the whole, so that actually lowers the level of kodesh because you have a weaker foundation. You've chipped away at some of the foundation by pushing too much of the emphasis in the kodesh, and that causes a problem in the ultimate resolve. Im nimshachas tekufa shachomer toveas dikayon shelo, but eventually the whole is going to have to kind of reclaim itself. It's going to have to rebound. Umari de chol v'dachik v'neshech v'maris notel achol es chovo me'akodesh v'chutzpah misgaberes. So eventually that kind of disproportionate existence where the kodesh is being elevated and emphasized to the detriment of the whole, so eventually that balance is going to have to be shifted because there's going to, you know, the equilibriums are going to change, and then there's going to be the opposite result, and the whole is going to end up, you know, things are going to shift to the sides of the whole is going to reclaim itself, it's going to charge interest, you know, it's been neglected, so now it needs to make up for that neglection, and it has to charge interest, and then it's going to result in a totally opposite extreme where the whole is going to be that much more emphasized and significant. But then ultimately, he says that this sort of cycle, it sounds like it's almost a vicious cycle, but ultimately this cycle leads just higher and higher levels of elevation, because when the kodesh goes up and the chol goes down, so then the chol has to kind of attack back and shift the balance in the other direction, so the chol goes up. So then to elevate that chol into the kodesh, so you're going up to here, so you're constantly going up and up and up, you know, in this sort of cycle where ultimately it's going to end in a, that this is the, you know, his notion of the kodesh hakadoshim, where the chol and the kodesh are constantly building off of one another to ultimately reach, you know, this ultimate level of perfection. So it's a very esoteric sort of idea, but this is kind of the construct that he works with, and the application where, you know, when he's talking, he, you know, alludes to this in his invocation to the Hebrew at the Hebrew University at the inauguration. So the, you know, the application of this to the world of secular knowledge is that basically that, you know, the idea that we have to, that the notion of understanding the wisdom of the world and using that as a foundation, that's a key part to this whole equation of elevating the secular to the Kodesh, which is ultimately what we're looking to do in terms of the ultimate purpose of the world. Here in source number 8, you know, he says, the second tendency characterizing Jewish spirituality served not only to deepen the sacredness of Torah within, but also as a means for the propagation and absorption of ideas. That this notion of, you know, including the, you know, to studying the secular world in order to incorporate that into our Torah, into our Kedusha, and thereby uplifting the secular, but also expanding the Kodesh. That's, you know, it's doing both at the same time, and that's really what he talks about as, you know, the contribution of a place like Hebrew University, where there's going to be a high level of secular knowledge and intellectual pursuit, that ultimately that's going to contribute to this ultimate worldly progression in the realm of Kodesh and Chol, and specifically in the realm of, you know, building our own spiritual personalities and our own intellectual and spiritual milieu. So that's kind of, you know, the mystical level. And granted, it's a little bit difficult to kind of incorporate into our own intellects, considering that I assume that most of us here are not well versed and deep in the studies of Kabbalah and the like. But that sort of model, which is one where you're really, the secular knowledge is, you know, is part and parcel of the ultimate plan, and it is in itself enabling and enhancing the Kedusha. So that's really a very crucial model to be aware of. And Rabbi Lam talks about this in his book.
Not that different than the Gra. In other words, he's...
Right, but the Gra is using it in a purely practical sense, in the sense that there are parts of the Torah where you will just be able to understand things on a much clearer level because you have a good foundation in math. So then if you were reading the Gemara that's trying to figure out, you know, the areas of rooms for mezuzahs, or the area of a sukkah for what's the minimal size of a sukkah, so if you understand how mathematics work and you understand how the area of a circle works, so then you'll be able to understand what the Gemara is trying to do when it's trying to figure out, is this sukkah kosher, is this sukkah too big, is this too small, etc. But not that endeavor did anything to the math. The math isn't holy now. The math was just a tool that was necessary. And that tool, it didn't enable the Torah to be lifted to another level of Kedusha that the Torah would not have been able to reach on its own. It was just a way of understanding the Torah, which is crucial. But again, it's only on the very pragmatic plane. Here, what Rav Kook is saying is that there's this constant progression between, you know, in the world, that the Kedusha is constantly rising in its level and is constantly being expanded, and that can only happen by incorporating more wisdom, more of the mundane, and elevating it in the process. So that's why it's a more fundamental sort of perspective. And this fundamental perspective kind of has a parallel in, I guess we would call it the Yeshiva University sort of model, the model that, you know, the Rav sort of, he didn't, it's you know, ironic on many levels that the Rav didn't really write so much about this topic directly per se. I mean, it's clear from his writing that he was a Gaon Atzum in all areas of knowledge, including the Torah and beyond. But he very rarely really spoke about this in a, you know, systematic sort of sense, in the same way that, you know, Rabbi Lam wrote a book, Torah Mada, and goes through different aspects of it. And, you know, Rabbi Lichtenstein wrote articles that really went through a very detailed manner and fashion on this topic. The Rav, who's kind of the, you know, at the forefront of this sort of model that we'll discuss now, didn't really write so much directly about it, but we'll call this model the spiritual complement. The idea that there's a whole nother aspect to our spiritual personality which can be developed and enhanced that does not get serviced to the fullest by just studying Torah. That there are things outside of the Torah that will enhance our spiritual personality and our spiritual makeup in a way that the Torah doesn't necessarily. And that endeavor is by definition a positive endeavor because it's kind of filling out our spiritual personality. So the Rav, he kind of talks about this aspect of man, this aspect of man kind of integrating the world and understanding the world. He talks about it in A Lonely Man of Faith kind of indirectly. And the way when he talks about it there, he's really referencing specifically science, which is, you know, something we mentioned earlier on in the shiur, the idea that in theory there are definitely different subjects at hand, and some subjects, you know, you might approach in one way, and some subjects you might approach in another way. So science is one of those subjects where you kind of would have more consensus that there's what to be gained, in the sense that science really deals directly with God's hand in the world and God's the world that God created. And in that sense, understanding science and understanding the world in that regard is definitely going to lead one to a better appreciation and understanding of Hashem. So in that regard, so that's kind of how the Rav is using a sort of a scientific model in his discussion. But we'll see that it goes beyond that. So here he talks about the famous Adam 1 and Adam 2, the first two prakim of Sefer Bereishis, where it seems like the story of man's creation is repeated twice. So the Rav tries to develop that there are two components to man, and that's what, and each perek is trying to emphasize the different components. So he says here, Adam the first, the first relation of the story is Adam, number one. Adam the first, who was fashioned in the image of God, was blessed with great drive for creative activity and immeasurable resources for the realization of this goal, the most outstanding of which is the intelligence, the human mind, capable of confronting the outside world and inquiring into its complex workings. In spite of the boundless divine generosity providing man with many intellectual capacities and interpretive perspectives in his approach to reality, God, in imparting the blessing to Adam the first and giving him the mandate to subdue nature, directed Adam's attention to the functional and practical aspects of his intellect through which man is able to gain control of nature. So here, the Rav, specifically emphasizes the notion of understanding nature. This is like the more scientific avenue of knowledge, and that this is part and parcel of man's makeup. That part of man's object in this world is to conquer the world, subdue nature, to really have a full and complete understanding of the world, and that's. In that sense, he's going to become closer to the Ribono Shel Olam. So here the Rav actually says that other intellectual inquiries, such as the metaphysical or axiological qualitative, no matter how incisive and penetrating, have never granted man dominion over his environment. So, these sort of more esoteric subjects, the Greeks who excelled in philosophical noesis were less skillful in technological achievements. Modern science has emerged victorious from its encounter with nature because it has sacrificed qualitative metaphysical speculation for the sake of a functional duplication of reality and substituted the quantus for the qualis question. So he's specifically, focusing on the science to the exclusion of these other, more philosophical aspirations in this regard. Because he's focusing on man's conquering of the world and better understanding and better appreciation in terms of a very natural scientific perspective. But he's admitting that that is a component of man's makeup, of man's spiritual makeup. That's Adam 1. Adam 2 is going to be a totally different story. But Adam 1, that's Adam 1's component, that's a part and parcel of each and every one of us. So this is sort of the foundation for the more expansive, the notion of another spiritual component to man that exists, that is fed and nourished through these other pursuits that Rav Lichtenstein really embellishes.
The Rav is limiting it to science.
So in this particular instance, he's focusing on the scientific natural dominion that man is supposed to have in the world, and he is because he's focusing on man's place in the world as the the kivshuha to conquer the world. So that's what he's focusing on here. So this is really as far as I know from, I've read many works of the Rav. I mean, as far as I know, this is really the only sort of place where he even kind of talks about this notion directly in the sense of what is the spiritual benefit to these, to secular knowledge. This is kind of the place where he kind of, touches on it head on.
Practical knowledge.
But in this section, he's dealing with practical secular knowledge in the sense of, science and nature. That doesn't mean that he didn't believe in a more expansive version. It's just that, in the writings that I'm familiar with, it's just not directly there. I mean, it's clear that he assumes that sort of mentality. I mean, if you read any of his essays, any of his philosophy, so his whole worldview is informed based on the Torah, but he's incorporating such a vast wealth of knowledge in all aspects of the world that is, clearly is affecting how he views things. And he's, you know, he's using that, and he makes it clear that he's using that in all of his in his philosophy. So not, you know, that he represented that he believed in this is, you know, I think is probably very clear. It's just in terms of, you know, some people who, you know, tackle the topic of Torah Umado or this notion of secular wisdom head on, so he just didn't do it. He just I don't know why.
It's not clear to me though what he why he juxtaposes metaphysics as quality and science as quantity. I mean, there's no, doesn't science ever look for quality also? I mean, I don't understand why.
Right. I think the quality versus quality, I think he kind of is associating with the why versus the how. I think that's, you know, from the continuation of his work in The Lonely Man of Faith. I think that's kind of how he's setting it up. That's what, you know, I think that's what he means by it. But that's really more of a, that's more relevant for the topic of, you know, the two components of man that he's dealing with in that part. We want to just kind of, pull out for a second, just kind of this foundation for this other spiritual component that exists in terms of what man, you know, to nourishing his this other aspect of man. And then we'll just conclude with, I guess, the continuation of this legacy with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in this article that he wrote that's published in Judaism's Encounter with Other Cultures. And here, just, you know, to kind of sum up how he views this, you know, how secular knowledge can fill out sort of our spiritual picture. He says, nonetheless, the most significant potential contribution to Judaism, as well as its most controversial, referring to the, you know, the notion of secular wisdom, inheres in yet a third capacity, as a spiritual complement, or if you will, supplement. Chachma can inform and irradiate our spiritual being by rounding out its cardinal Torah component. It affects this either by casting light, if not upon the stuff of Torah proper, its basic texts and concepts with all their derivatives, than upon the issues to which they relate, or alternative, by expanding our spiritual and intellectual horizons through exposure to other areas of potential religious import. Which is, I think, I don't know if this is the article you were referencing, but this is where he goes on, and I'll show you, I'll read from this. I mean, he goes on and he goes through in this article, and he talks about history, and he talks about literature, and he talks about psychology, and he quotes examples of what he means from Milton and from Shakespeare and from different works and from Aristotle. He goes through and he gives like concrete examples of, you know, different, you know, nuggets of wisdom and jewels that you can, that are there to, you know, to be fought, yeah, to be nurtured and to be incorporated into the spiritual personality. But just to give you a basic sense of what he kind of, you know, the approach that he's getting at here is, he writes that secular studies possess, and this is in a more condensed article in Leaves of Faith, secular studies possess immense intrinsic value insofar as they generally help to develop our spiritual personality. Time and again, they intensify our insight into basic problems of moral and religious thought. History and the sciences show us the divine revelation manifested in human affairs and the cosmic order. The humanities deepen our understanding of man, his nature, functions, and duties. In one area after another, a whole range of general studies sustains religion, supplementing and complementing it in a sense deeper and broader than we have hitherto perceived.
He right? Didn't use the word duties. That's interesting because he did use that. I remember it was like a dig almost at some people who were a little bit, we're not sensitive, at least he thought, to the problem. And he mentioned that, you know, reading this literature would
give you a sense into human nature, into human thought, into psychology. So what you have is really, you know, obviously, you know, a bunch of different models. You have a few varying perspectives, you know, from the extreme of it's, you know, it's not for us, yeah, to it's not only is it helpful to us in a practical way, but it's, you know, crucial in our ultimate goal as a people in terms of elevating the everything to Kedusha and as well as kind of filling out our own spiritual personalities. So you see there's a very broad spectrum in terms of how this uh, th- this sh- this sort of topic should be integrated. And of course, you know, this is just kind of a very basic overview, and that, you know, every person is a particular in their own ways and has different aspects, can relate to different aspects in different ways. And for some people, you know, one sort of model might speak to them in a very significant way, and for others, it might be a very different model. And it's really a very personal question. There's, you know, Rav Lichtenstein himself talks about this, and there's a lot of literature on this also in terms of, so now that you have the models, so now what does that mean? So what do? I mean, practically, there's a lot out there, and there's a lot to accomplish, and it's hard. And so that's obviously a very, you know, much more personal question in terms of how that should be done. But at least as a concept for kind of a perspective in the world, at least on the very basic level of just appreciating that it's there and that it's out there, and that there's more, much more than what meets the eye. So I think that's really a crucial element for everybody, regardless of how intensely this is integrated in a practical way in terms of how people divide their time, etc. So I hope this was
very nice year. Thank you.
But you know, it's a scary thing historically that if you have the Vilna going on a historical level, and he says, well, it'll enhance our Torah world, and then subsequently, why would people even disagree? I mean, like, he would be like the post that you have to follow and not change.
Right. So I think the basic sense that you would get, you know, even from Rav Ochanan, would be something like, granted there are some elements of truth to some of these things, but the risk-reward factor is just that the risk is too great.
Uh-huh. And he also mentioned Bitul right. Torah, too.
And
which was more, well, not just risk.
If you infuse the Kedusha into the secular, then on a personal level, when I went to YU, I was pre-med. I chose medicine because I looked at the way Hashem created the body, the biology, chemistry, whatever. And I said, Zeg Kalevian Veil. And maybe naive of me to think that way, but I look at the way Hashem created nature, and I still say that.
Right.
So that's the way. Now, unfortunately, there is a Meisesh Hoyon. I can mention his name. There's a Rabbi Moshe Meiselman, who was a Musmach of Skokie Yeshiva, went to MIT as a PhD in either science or physics, started a very black hat yeshiva in Israel, and absolutely refuses to allow his
students to go to YU,
to go into any secular subjects. No secular whatsoever.
Isn't he the rabbi's nephew?
Brother. Yeah, I think he's some. He's there's some relationship there.
His mother is a celibate.
Yeah, some relationship.
I don't remember exactly what. She's alive.